Okay, so without much interruption or delay, we're going to go ahead and get started with the next panel. Medium access and new contacts reinventing the wheel. These are the set of panelists. And I think we've coordinated a little bit. We've talked, and luckily we've got some dissension that will create some discussion. We'll see how that goes. Since we were doing quotes yesterday, I thought I'd put up a couple of quotes about sort of the distinction between science and engineering. Especially as we think about some of these issues from the theoretical perspectives and also the issues of practicality, I think what we'll start to see is that there are also issues of what happens in academia versus what happens in industry, and that sort of transitions across the boundaries as well. So with that lengthy introduction, I'm going to turn it over to John, and we'll get started.
So I was asked to go first. So clearly, we have lots of old wine, right? That's why we're all here. You guys know all these acronyms. You can add many to them, I'm sure. And this is just a tiny fraction of them. The interesting thing, and what might ask, after all this, what's really left to do? And in fact, Cohn has a list of all MAC protocols, and he says we run out of single-letter MAC protocols. In fact, he's on the Greek. Something of the Cyrillic, I suppose. So the interesting thing, though, is there are some new wineskins, right? And so I'm going to talk briefly about four, right? Low power, which is kind of old now, but software-defined radios, ultra-wide, and underwater are all sort of fertile areas. So let's, and before we think about these things, you know, they're all pretty much driven by two things. One is some kind of technological change, and the other is some kind of driving application. And actually, as I was listing these, the one interesting thing is software-defined radio is, I'm not quite sure why anybody's doing that, except that it's such an intriguing technological change that I think it's worth considering. But the other cases, at least, I think there's all compelling applications. Even if all we've done is reduce ultra-wideband to a boring cable replacement for video, you know, people seem to think they're going to buy that. So let's start with low power, right? That's something we're all pretty familiar with right now. As we shifted to much shorter distance wireless transmission, that actually, from the many kilometer kind of radios from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that actually shifted the ratio of transmit energy to receive energy, and in fact, even to listen energy. That huge shift left open a room for a lot of opportunity to optimize power, because all of a sudden, we couldn't just talk about the way I model power is how many packets do I send. You have to think about how often do I bother listening, how often do I bother receiving, and those start to dominate power consumption. So this is no longer a new context, but I think this represents an area where there's been a lot of innovation. And if you think about that innovation, though, it built on the framework of the few sort of seminal designs, right? Contention-based versus scheduled protocols, right? It's kind of hard to get something radically new, although you could blend them, you could add very important tweaks which have huge power performance issues, orders of magnitude. So I think we've seen a lot of that. I'm not going to go into details about that. So switch to something like ultra-wideband, a little bit more recent technology, and to me, from my naive upper layer point of view, the interesting thing about ultra-wideband is basically it's really, really fast, at least over short distances. And so, again, that enables these new kind of applications. And I think there, though, the implications on the MAC protocol are perhaps a little bit more evolutionary. And UWE people can perhaps correct me during questions, but that's my quick take. However, this diagram is very interesting. What makes ultra-wideband compelling is perhaps that it can push into a new part of the design space. And then we can ask, if we push into that new part of the design space, does that have MAC implications? So that's sort of the opportunity there. So software-defined radios, I think, are even more fascinating because, mainly because of the fourth to last bullet on here, they potentially offer a huge improvement in turnaround from research idea to actually somebody caring. In that if you have a software-defined radio that I can reprogram, maybe we can get these wild and crazy ideas about sending two packets at once, or changing MAC protocols, RTS/CTS, or PHY coding optimally based on, you pick your favorite thing. Basically, what can we as a research community do with a lot more plasticity and not a 5-year hardware to actually algorithm design kind of turnaround phase? And in particular, going back to this diagram here of time, space, range, can we actually start to have one modem that can actually agilely move from different parts of space around in different parts of space depending on needs? So that's a real interesting opportunity. The last thing I want to go into a little bit more detail is underwater, and that's been an area of my work recently, and among other people here as well. And the interesting thing is when you go underwater, you shift from RF to acoustic because of the huge attenuation that RF gets underwater. And this results in a massive change in basically all the parameters that we care about: bit rate, latency, attenuation. Actually, if you go to acoustic, it actually goes very long distance once you get it out the door. So I think here there's a lot more potential for revolutionary ideas, although still working within the framework of contention-based and scheduled protocols. And so I wanted to go into a little bit more detail about one specific thing there. So one thing that you get underwater, if you're talking acoustic, is you start to talk about propagation delays, not of milliseconds, but of tens of milliseconds, or hundreds, or even thousands, or thousands of milliseconds. And so you get this problem if you're trying to do traditional carrier sense, that you basically can't, right? So if D tries to transmit here, if D tries to transmit here at one time, and A is listening to the channel to see if it's busy, well, it takes a while for that signal to get to A. So if A times out too quickly, it's not going to know that the channel is busy. And in fact, if A waits long enough to guarantee that it hears these transmissions, it's waiting potentially seconds. And that's really going to kill your throughput. And so you get kind of collisions because of this challenge with carrier sense. So the opportunity here is to view this as an option that we can exploit, not just as a problem we have to fight. And so one thing, a student of mine working with Wei Yi, the student's Afan Sayed, started to explore is this concept of sending an early packet that's very short that lets you acquire the channel. So like an RTS, CTS sort of thing. But it can just be a tone, right? It just can be a paging channel kind of thing. And as long as this is short, we can actually exploit the fact that there is time-space that there's this sort of time-space uncertainty. We can exploit that fact because different people will receive those two tones, the red and green tones, at different times. And so if A and D try to transmit at exactly the same time, because the packets move at different speeds and the nodes are in different locations, we can actually not only detect contention, but we can actually count the contenders. And because the nodes in the middle each get the packet at different times. And so we've used this to improve contention-based MACs. Actually, another group, Michel Chorsi's group at La Sapienza, used the same concept in a scheduled MAC to basically say, can I choose when I transmit such that if I'm saying one thing and Oogly in the back is saying one thing, that you can all hear it, even though we're transmitting at the actual same time, because it takes so long to get to each one of you. So that's the idea. I'm only going to show you our idea, of course, but so the MAC idea is basically, you know, your typical thing we want to contend, but because the packets move at different times and arrive at different times, we can actually count how they arrive because they actually arrive in the middle there. Because they cross and arrive at different nodes at different places at different times, so we can actually count how many people are trying to contend. And so we can count in the top first round there are two contenders. Now, we do a traditional kind of back-off scheme such that you probabilistically decide if you're going to contend in the next round. But the interesting thing is we can tune that back-off scheme because we know exactly, or we know with high probability, how many people are trying to contend. That's not something you can do in RF because things go by too fast because of the channel, because you step on each other all the time. Okay, so the interesting thing is this kind of rapid convergence and ability to count contenders means we can not only do well at low utilizations because we're a contention-based protocol, can also be very stable at high utilizations because people have a very good idea of how many people are trying to access the channel, and we can back off appropriately. So just to summarize my sort of position, the old one is very important. It's the basis upon which we build, but the radically different parameters we're living in these new environments have some really interesting opportunities, maybe not to invent the new aloha, but to change in a substantial way. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. Any questions while we're switching? Elizabeth, you go.
So it doesn't seem like with the short little pulses that you can get around the delay propagation time, right? You still have to wait to receive this.
Absolutely. You're still stuck with a really, really slow protocol. And our rounds are half a second long.
So the benefit is just knowing the number of contenders?
And that lets you converge in two or three rounds. Less than three rounds with very high probability, as opposed to binary exponential backoff, where it takes log n rounds.
The question is, regarding UWB, somewhat different myself. Trying to think about the inference strategy on UWB, how should the map look like? And especially, I think, 8.2.15.4, that's stuck or not implemented the UWB better. So I wanted to know what you think are the small changes that should be done.
So that's a good question. So I'm not a UWB expert, so maybe we can pass that question to others.
We work with MIST on that. And what is interesting in EWB is that you actually need two antennas, one only and one directional, try to find the users and then track it because of the extreme narrowness. So that creates some other changes in MAC. And actually, we have made a contribution and written to the standard. And you need online ray tracing methods to actually find that I can catch him this way, but then how do I find where he is and how do I align? So this really changes the dimension of the size of the design space. But there are very interesting things to do with that.
I think another issue which I hoped I would see is that, so you have the potential for very fine time resolution, but acquiring that time resolution comes at a cost, right? So there's this synchronization latency that exists that you can play off with. And of course, because of the characteristics of the signals, even though they're not truly, DC on, you don't know exactly what your line of sight is. And so that really changes when things actually start. And so I think it would be very interesting to see how higher layer activity would change based on even these two small differences.
The question I wanted to ask you is about the underworld. In the underworld channel, you have a very interesting phenomenon because you have dielectric layers, and you can have actually very good channels at some points and very bad channels at other times. This is, of course, only the acoustic medium. And some of the most modern type of group that they use both RF for short distance and long distance for acoustic. But let's stay with the acoustic. They are quite accurate model of the acoustic ocean. The people, for instance, if you go to the Naval School up here, they use almost online to find the electric
layers. What's the question? I'm sorry.
The question is, do you see an opportunity for opportunistic map in this? Where, because if I know when I'm going to be my good distances, right, and I don't have a lot of users, right? It's more
so,
like along the work in Sapienza, but you see that.
So I absolutely see opportunity for opportunistic maps. And in fact, ours is a contention-based map. Our particular interest is more of a... So there are a lot of existing and commercial long-range acoustic modems, and the properties you talked about ducting and very good long-range propagation are pretty specific to long-range. The space we're very interested in is, can we recreate a sensor-net-like world with short-range dense communication. So we're trying hard to avoid all of those opportunities. However, others can.
But I think those are hard to take advantage of because you need to know a lot about exactly where you are and exactly where your receiver is.
But like John said, the prediction is very important because you have delays. And you have to predict where you're going to be to use the opportunity.
Right.
So I think that represents another opportunity.
And how cold it is and how deep, it's...
Good.
Okay.
Hit it.
Okay. So at a broad level, I think I'm going to support what John say, although from, I'm trying to argue from a different perspective, I'm from a theoretical side of things. So Matt, are you saying anything new? In a way, looked at one way, it's not much new. In a sense, most of the new protocols that we have been seeing are, as John mentioned, are really variants of the basic protocols, contention with either contention based or scheduled, Aloha, CSMA, token passing, reservation based, and so on. So fundamentally, we are not seeing something really fundamentally new. I mean, do we expect to see fundamentally new, considering that people have been working on these kind of issues for 30 years? Probably not. I mean, it's finally a problem of choosing kind of independent transmissions, or independent sets. How many ways can we come up with that? But of course, we have seen some new ideas when we're coupling physical layer issues with the MAC, as we've seen in previous panel. But if you just consider the MAC problem as it is, I mean, you probably can't think of many fundamentally new ways of doing it. Many of minor tweaks and even repetitions. These things are flooded with papers, and we don't have time to read others' works. And forget about going 20 years back and taking a look at what Kleiner has done, right? And naturally, we are repeating some of the work, and that's unfortunate, but that's how it stands right now. And we try to identify a problem with the protocol, the one recipe which results in a lot of these protocols, minor variants of each other, is we try to identify a problem with a protocol in a particular context, we fix the problem, but we propose a protocol which has some other problems of its own, which somebody else fixes. And we have a series of protocols. And one reason why we are having this is because we don't have a very clear notion of what the goal is, what the optimum should be, and so on. So having said that, does it mean that we should give up on math research? Okay, I would say not quite. Because we are realizing that many of the well-known protocols do not really work in many of the emerging scenarios, the large-scale arbitrary topology networks, ad hoc or sensors, whatever. Long delays, high attenuations, which John was just mentioning, high mobility scenarios, large number of channels, and so on. Okay, we have argued this in the yesterday and earlier today, and because. In some sense, these basic protocols, Aloha, CSM, and so on, are probably not designed for these kind of scenarios. They're probably designed for access point networks, point-to-point networks, and so on, or completely mesh networks, or a LAN setting, and so on. And secondly, cognitive radios can provide us with more flexibility in the MAC design than we ever had. We can really start with thinking, designing from scratch, cognitive radios or software-defined radios, can allow us to do that. And we're also realizing that our analysis simulations, the models that we use in analysis simulations are often very simplistic, okay? And not tied up with a five-layer reality that we've been arguing earlier. And doing a perfect scheduling has unrealistically high complexity, right? Trying to find a maximum independent set, something like that are very complex, and which is not feasible if the nodes are moving, the network is not static. And so we have to settle down with something that is suboptimal, but we still want to it to be efficient. And so how is the ongoing math research useful? I think we are really putting to test existing math protocols in extreme environments, like as in the case of unwater sensor networks, in UAV networks, with networks that are widely varying topologies, changing topologies, long delay, high mobility, with a very large number of channels where you cannot probably have an idea of what's going on in many of the channels. A small tweak, what appears like a small tweak, can make a huge difference of properties. And that's why we see, even within the framework of CSMA, there's been so much research on how to tune the backup windows, for instance, because it can seriously make a difference on the throughput and the performance of the protocol. And we're also seeing fresh insights to the MAC design and prompting us to question the original design as well. In some sense, CSMA is also cognitive. It strives to adapt itself to the number of contending stations, right? But is that the optimal way of doing it is the best way of doing it. Maybe you can come up with another way of adapting and trying to find out how many convenience stations are there and so on. So this can help us in new application, new scenarios, can help us question all these basic protocols and try to develop something better. And also what we have been seeing lately is a better integration of MAC and file layer properties, which I think is very important. Okay, and this also gives us a new way of looking at the MAC. So coming from this analysis and optimization perspective, let me just focus a little bit on what's going on that front and how new emerging applications is fostering the research in that area, developing new problems and relevant problems. So in some sense, at a high-level perspective, at an abstract level, if you're trying to abstract things out, so different emerging scenarios can be viewed as imposing different types of degrees of constraints on the controller communication overhead or the delay tolerance and so on. And it prompts us to examine the existing protocols for arbitrary topologies. What is the performance in the worst case topology, or under very large delays, or under very limited feedback, and so on. And also it calls for the joint optimization of the MAC and physical layer property. So let me just quickly point out the three topics, just as a sample. I've worked a little on this topic, and there are a lot of people in this room who have also worked on these topics, just as a sample. So one is the analysis and optimization of random access, a low coordination or low coordination maximum scheduling schemes, which has become a growing area. There's a lot of recent work in that area, and the reason for a lot of interest in this is applications like highly mobile networks where you cannot really do any soft state scheduling. You could probably talk to your neighbors, get the local topology, and you have to make a quick decision because the topology is changing all the time. You cannot do any sophisticated scheduling. So it kind of justifies or leads us to consider random access schemes and try to make the best use of random access schemes. Also look at scheduling, which are very low complexity, which are kind of local information, local topology based. Forward engineering map. This is also a growing body of work, and it's clearly led by the software, developing the software-defined radios area. If you have software-defined radios, maybe you can think forward and design new protocols from scratch. And then people have looked at multi-channel systems, channel assignment, power assignment, joint channel and power assignment, and so on for a long time. But with wide access systems, a lot of multiple channels, what is becoming of interest is what can you do if you have limited channel state information. You can measure only a few channels, or you have, in general, you have a very limited channel state feedback. How do you do scheduling that makes optimal use of all the channels based on this limited feedback? There's also a growing body of literature in that area. There's also clearly fostered with this emerging applications. In summary, I believe that new application scenarios are indeed imposing fresh challenges to the MAC design, and it's leading us to look at the MAC performance for arbitrary topologies, limited feedback, and long delays, and also leading us to think into MAC design from scratch. And from a theorist perspective, I think we are very far away from coming up with real bounds on how what a MAC algorithm would do under limited feedback, or given some limited feedback on the communication complexity, delay, and so on. And finally, of course, we have to translate these results into protocols, or when you come up with protocols, we have to compare under a given scenario, compare them with these theoretically predicted bounds and so on. So that's pretty much all I have. Yes?
Question. From a practical perspective, and not considerations of analytical effectability, is there any reason we should be looking at ANOVA variants as opposed to just CSMA and CA?
There can be scenarios where I would think that doing carrier sensing may not be feasible. Like, right? I don't know, John, does carrier sensing make sense in underwater sensor networks?
No. Not unless you do fancy things.
And also, like, in satellite networks also. I mean, I think Aloha, like,
no, but sort of, let's say if we limit ourselves to terrestrial systems that are even sensor nets or ad hoc nets or mesh.
Yeah, another thing is...
I guess what I'm getting at is that, I mean, there's still... This is one of those things where, if you're a theoretician, it's very attractive to start with the
Aloha model
start to build, but it's never clear to me that you learn lessons there that translates to a CSMACA. So are these papers just, you know, only... Do you see what I'm getting at?
No, I worked a bit on Aloha models, then I worked on CSMA models as well. In some cases, the CSM models, we have some under very idealistic assumptions. I think John was also going towards that direction yesterday, and Patrick, and so on. So you can get derived models for CSMA, but they are much, much more complex than a simple Aloha model.
Sure.
And working with the Aloha model is provide me with some insights which I was, I've been able to use in the CSMA model. Of course, the results are not really nearly as nice as what we had with the Aloha model.
I guess where I have difficulty is seeing examples where I see, you know, what I've learned from the Aloha model is being really useful in the CSMA settings.
Yeah, I wouldn't
and
say it was
a large portion of the literature that's devoted to, you know, something that's really pedagogically useful. Like if I'm teaching students, the first thing about randomized access, I want to teach them about Aloha, certainly, but I'm not sure we should be devoting this much attention to.
That's probably true. I mean, I wouldn't say I could directly take an Aloha result and apply to the CSMA, but I think it has given me some insights which I could apply later on. But also, I think there might be some renewed interest in Aloha. I mean, the systems people can argue for or against that. In different scenarios, particularly if you're building a sensor network, it's probably would be communicating not all the time. Okay? And also, you want to reduce the cost. Probably putting some carrier sensing hardware may increase the cost. So why not just randomly transmit, which becomes an Aloha layer. And so, I mean, depending on the scenarios, the cost limitations, and so on, will lead you to whether you're using Aloha or CSMA.
You mentioned max integration with five, which kind of makes sense and seems like a good agenda to follow. Wondering if there's something to like integration of max with high layers like routing or something for multi-hop setting, and is that going to change like the max design fundamentally if you look at it like that?
It might. I have not seen myself max being integrated with routing. I don't know if anybody else.
So the result I cited, the Bhagya result, basically was a joint map scheduling approach. And it works because time scale is so long underwater that you're able to get away with that.
The big picture idea is integrate routing and much. Because you go to the least back picture, which may be a different path.
Could you say that loud,
the back picture results, integrate routing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in some sense, the Jasper Submarine is all this end-to-end flow type thing. So they kind of integrate the routing with the scheduling, in some sense, I guess.
Well, also, in sensor nets for sleep scheduling, routing delays are affected by the sleeps that you put in the MAC layer. So that's also a
good
point. Another example is the idea of opportunistic routing. You just broadcast and see who gets it. You pick the relay node after the transmission, not before.
And then you can combine this opportunistic routing with opportunistic scheduling format, actually.
Right. So there's different diversities you can explore. So I think there are all these ideas out there. Eventually, I think in some way we are bound by this whole layered architecture and where we see that is going in the context of cross-layer optimization, how we want to change that. And
go ahead, let's do one more quick question.
So one of the things that I don't think is necessarily driven by new technology as much as sort of new reasonable architectures. One of the success stories of MAC and PHY is when you sort of escalate modulation schemes like OFGM and CVM and you take them to meet the effective MAC when you have a single hop cellular, you know, sort of completely orchestrated. I mean, that's the success story of a wireless networking in some ways, right? So, any thoughts about that, right? I mean, it doesn't throw away MAC, but the CDMA MAC is very different from the typical MAC we tend to think when we teach on networking.
No, that is true. I mean, I think most of the MAC research, I think, has been geared towards other types of physical layer, right? Not exactly CDMA. But I can think of issues that come up in that area as well. And when you talk about the WiMAX type scenarios, I mean, the MAC issues over there are quite different. And there's, again, serious issues. You might not have contention as such, but there are power allocation, joint power allocation channel assignment. You, as I was mentioning, with a large number of channels, you can only get feedback on a few, whether you're transmitting or whatever we're probing. And then there are also, again, very serious issues over there, but it's in a different direction altogether.
Okay. With that, let's go ahead and do
Thanks. So I would start out by just saying that, you know, I don't work in Mac, haven't worked for a while. I'm a very cynical view towards it, and some of it will probably reflect in my short three-slide presentation. Apologies in advance to if I offend you. Reinventing the wheel, certainly. John mentioned the alphabet soup of Mac protocols, that's very true. But he also cited energy and how in the context of SenseNet sort of some amazing things happen. I would just say that those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it, and I think we did, and I did my share of contributions to that. The whole thesis behind things like low-power listening, preamble, or tone, or packet train type sampling, which is pretty much has emerged as a seed of what are the low-power protocols, is based on the observation that the receiver power, relatively speaking, dominates. We forgot about paging systems. That was another type of system where the receiver power dominated. Go back, look at the patents from 70s, 80s. These ideas are out there. We ended up reinventing. We think it's new, unfortunately. So, and I think there are other examples which have been cited as well. What I do believe is that as time goes on, sort of newer technologies in particular, and sometimes new applications, do give us an engineering perspective, engineering trade-offs. Maybe I'm too much of an engineer in that regard, but I think that's where some interesting, at least engineering opportunities, if not fundamental ones, do emerge. And a couple that I would like to cite, one which John did mention, and so did Kaushik, which is software-defined radios. They appear pretty selective. We can span that entire sort of space-time graph, supposedly. But there's no free lunch. What's the cost out here? So we want reconfigurability. We believe it could be done in software. We can certainly maintain the throughputs by doing larger and larger blocks of processing while doing the signal processing, but it comes at the cost. There is a throughput latency trade-off eventually when you do computation like this, and that latency comes to the fore. If you look at pretty much any of the software radio platforms.
So we had some discussion about this yesterday, Mani, but is this still an issue if you do this on an FPGA? Like if you knew what you were doing and put it on the FPGA?
Unless you are willing to commit a very high bandwidth between your sampler and the FPGA, it certainly gets mitigated, but it's not software radios or software defined systems. So you're pushing back into hardware, and perhaps that's what needs to be done. If we chase this vision of software defined radios, then we'll have to deal with this latency. There goes our notion of we can have radios which will cooperate with all sort of existing MAC protocols.
Yeah, I really think that if you're willing to push some functionality into the FPGA closer to the radio, things do change fundamentally, I think. Some of the latency goes down.
Some of it, yes, but ultimately, unless we are able to get around that fee computation resides in packet coming in, our response going out, kind of scenario, take 802.11, pretty much everything, you have that fee processing in the loop. It basically means you're pushing it back into hardware, which is what we started out against.
Yeah, but there are, so let me just make a quick leadership comment. So the first one is, you can bring it down a lot, and actually, I don't think we necessarily need to focus on implementing 802.11 in the radio. I just see it a bit like a red herring, right? But
Precisely.
But if you can just, you know, tens of microseconds, it's actually a long time. You can do a lot of processing that. But I think more importantly, I really don't think that people should look at the USRP1 combined with new radio running on the host as a prototypical platform.
Correct.
And design and make long-term decisions on how software radios can and cannot be used based on that, because USRP2 is already going to be very different. Some of the physical layer processing will be on the card. So I think the delays are going to be very
Yes and no. So since you brought up USRP2, since I was involved in kind of the project, DARPA project, which kind of led to that. So yes, I plan is to push some of the things out there. In particular, there's a notion called RSSI gating that USRP2 introduces. It doesn't push field layer processing down there. What it does do is that you can now say, I can pre-schedule a packet to be transmitted when a certain RSSI condition is met. But the actual processing of the samples is still up there. You switch to USB2, doesn't really solve the latency issue. So yes, it mitigates somewhat. I think the key point is software-defined radios are not going to let us be this I can implement everything. We'll have to design the MAC protocols around the consideration that this reconfigurability costs us something. And it's nothing fundamental, going back to my slide one. It's about engineering. Could do it, but this notion that somehow we'll have all these current standards implemented out there is not going to pan out. The second thing which I also want to bring out was going back to sort of scenarios where energy matters, or the notion, the role that time, and in particular how drift in your clock and sort of uncertainty of time affects the guard band and therefore the capacity, as well as it limits the duty cycling. There's a paper recently by folks at Berkeley that kind of showed that the kind of oscillators that we currently use fundamentally limit the duty cycle to around 0.01% just because of the drift that you get. In Sensenet's lot of data presented kind of seems to suggest that we should be able to, just from a capacity perspective, we should be able to go a lot lower. State-of-the-art John's SCP, which is pretty much the best I could find, is around 0.1% or so. The intriguing sort of thing is that our technology is emerging at various points. There is chip scale atomic clocks, which are tens of milliwatt but push things down to essentially negligible drift, to sort of better compensation techniques as well as better clock modeling techniques, which push things down to less than a ppm, 0.1 to 0.5 ppm kind of range with what seem to be reasonable power consumption. What impact would it have? How can we exploit these things? Superficially, it seems to me, channel usage, certainly these things should help. Energy, so myth seems to be that lower duty cycling will is the way out for achieving the lower energies. Some simple calculations for better clock sources to be viable and sort of push things like SCP further down, you're looking at clock sources which will need to be in microwatts, tens or hundreds of microwatts, and currently none of the technologies are there. So perhaps in some class of system, these things may help with energy, but sort of, again, from an engineering perspective, it seems also maybe that not really, but I'd like to hear, because one of the rationales behind DARPA's chip scale atomic clock program was indeed its role in communication technology. So that's all I had to say. And
any other comments?
So if I kind of understand what you're saying, it seems that your opinion is that there are all these developments we get excited about, but they come with trade-offs we don't seem to take into consideration when we are excited about them.
Absolutely. How important you think is this time problem?
How important is this time problem?
How limiting it is if I actually can not cooperate and do accurate time clocking by indirect method?
So firstly, if you can always have sort of message exchanges and pay that cost out there. A big part of it depends on the environment you're operating in. Drift does depend upon a lot of environment factors, and therefore, gap. Going back to SensorNet's kind of situation and whatnot, you often run into the situations where sort of node in the sun versus shade, sort of temperature differential is quite high or fairly rapidly changing at certain times. So those kind of situations you can. But just to give you a perspective, so FTSP, which is one of probably the most decent clock drift modeling, you could view it as equivalently a good clock for a very specific purpose at microwatt ranges, which is far superior to, let's say, something like atomic clock, which is giving us much lower drift, but at tens of milliwatt, which essentially precludes this usage for, because remember, clock cost you have to pay all the time, even when you are asleep.
Right, but what if I use something drastic like an overlay network, which gives a fairly accurate time impulse every so many milliseconds? I know I'm changing the problem, but this we can use the K25 these kind of problems.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing is not necessarily just a node problem; it's more of an architectural problem.
It depends if you have sleep and wake up protocols, right? You need a good clock to wake up.
So
yeah.
So Mani, a different question, the power steps for current sleep wake up protocols assume the main CPU is involved, even if it's a cheap CPU.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about a much simpler approach, which is just move this to hardware? The hardware guys know a thing or two. Kevin was actually mentioning that yesterday.
Yes, so interesting point. So, sort of the three bullets I had for the time, so the one which we get 0.1 ppm at 0.5 milliwatt, we thought that's great. Applied it to your SCP, no gain. The reason is because the duty cycles we are already achieving are low enough that even this incremental cost of simple oscillator is microwatts. Applying even the most simple of the hardware compensation techniques bumps us to milliwatt, takes us out of the tree. And let alone sort of going to chip scale coming up. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I have only two slides.
This one?
Not including this one. This one contains zero information. And there's absolutely no technical detail, but I'll try to put it more in the context of the theme of this workshop, that is, you know, the relationship between theory and practice. So I'll start by it's rarely exactly the same wheels. So this is somewhat repeating what you have already heard. There are always new contexts, new applications, new properties, new constraints, and just a couple of examples here. One, underwater communication, that's exactly what you, John, mentioned. New physical layer results. And that leads to new insights. And from that point of view, when we do modeling and analysis, we have a better understanding and perhaps different understanding as to what may be ignored, what may not be ignored, how to come up with a better abstraction of the problem at hand. And even if it is exactly the same methodology, the same protocol we're looking at, it's valid to verify whether it runs in a new system, right? So from that point of view, some of this is necessary and valid. On the other hand, there is unnecessary reinventing, and that's part of what Koshik and Mani just said. And I will say, first of all, reinvention doesn't require new contexts. We've seen reinvention in exactly the same context. I remember a couple of years ago, I go to these conferences, and there are papers about how 802.11 cannot handle this particular scenario, that particular scenario, and there is an improvement to that. Now, I myself I'm not a particular expert in this, and I don't have the standard, but often there's someone sitting next to me who will just say, if you look into the standards and the documentation, all these considerations have been gone through and discussed, and the final product, of course, is a compromise of various considerations, and they were not included. And all these were done. And if people would just take the time and go through it, they know that it had already been considered. So there is sort of repetition of work, even within just the same context. And there's also part of that, I think, is also influenced by what we already know how to do. But I think the bigger part of it is doing without knowing. So this is sort of the literature thing that was also just discussed. How far back do we look into literature? And on this point, I'll say here is what I sometimes see the gap between practice and theory, is that people who do practice are not aware of certain theoretical results that already exist for decades. Some of the theoretical results, some of these models that people came up with decades ago, are extremely powerful in general. This doesn't suggest that there's nothing to do, but I think people, and that goes to my last bullet, which is, I think there is a question about what defines a problem. Is it the application or is it the abstraction? And I think sometimes there's the tendency to think that as long as I have a new application scenario, I have a new problem. And that justifies doing, you know, as long as you think this is an emerging application, and therefore obviously nobody has ever done it, right? Because this is a new technology. But the fundamental abstraction, the model, may very well be, you know, very similar to what people have done years ago. So on that point, I'll say this is, I think, another aspect where perhaps some bridging between practice and theory would be very helpful. A better understanding of what theoretical results exist. And I think on the theoretician's part, it's also doing a community service to put their result in a better context. So practitioners can understand better. So even though perhaps they don't know the exact detail of the theory, but they know something like that exists, and perhaps there's a connection there. Yes?
So we've talked at length in this workshop about sort of the gap between theory and practice, and I guess what we ended up redefining that is just the gap between theoreticians and experimentalists that are all academic researchers. There's also this additional gap of academia versus industry, and you started to mention this about the standards process. I guess what worries me is that we kind of work in this complete cocoon where we're writing papers, and to some extent we recite each other's work and build on it, and at the end of it, it all goes to this giant black hole where it doesn't show up in the protocol standards. And anybody that, you know, that I've talked to that actually works with these standards say it takes a lot of time and effort, and it's not something that an academic would necessarily find rewarding, you know, as an individual. But at the same time, the people that are developing these standards are generally blissfully unaware of all the work that's happening in the academic community. So I personally see this as a giant, you know, gap between sort of theory and practice. Even if what you believe you're doing systems work, it's all theoretical because it doesn't show up in real systems that affect millions of lives. So
maybe the word is not theoretical, but hypothetical.
So, I mean, is there something we should be doing as a community to change that mode of operation, or that's just the way it's going to be?
So having been involved in some standard activities, not for wireless MAC, but some networking, you don't want to.
Right, so it's clear that that's not the right way. Is there an alternative?
I think the onus is unto us to be aware of what happened, how behind the standards and all. And you'll often discover, firstly, these standard processes are also not monolithic. They have competing things.
Sure.
Look at any of these gateways and other things. The same set of basic ideas and different permutations.
Yeah,
can happen for me. Other than sort of being aware of it and...
Well, how do we connect in the other direction, I guess, is what I don't see.
What happened, because you know the way the standards process works is, it's usually dictated more... a big consideration is, if I agree to this, will it give a... to market advantage to
I guess my bottom line question is, why are we doing all
yes,
this?
Exactly.
Never
if you're not going to affect anything in the real world, then why are you doing what we are doing?
I think ideally, academic research, we want it to be more forward. I think getting to this problem when you're tracking industry so closely,
So I guess I guess what you're saying is we should not write any papers on 802.11 because this is stuff we'll never be able to affect. So we should just
there's academic freedom, right?
Right. No, that's okay. I would agree with that standpoint, but I guess the question is there some other way
The tuition is reminiscent of computer architecture, in a way, right? Now, where the academic computer architecture research basically died because pretty much anything you would do didn't really have any impact. I think we're in a similar situation, and therefore go for farther out technologies and farther out theoretical concepts. I think, and trying to see their impact. I think that's.
Can we reject all the 8 to 11 papers from this point?
Well, and I think we do have some case studies where we have had some impact. So SensorNets was fairly far out. There were no 802.15.04 was not a mature standard when the work started, and the freedom of relatively programmable, crappy radios prompted a lot of innovation. So we can't have, and that did filter in some form to current standards.
In some cases, technology is just good enough. It's not perfect, but it's good enough. So Wi-Fi is not perfect, but it's probably good enough, right? So we have to make sure that if we keep on reinventing the wheel, there is a need for a new wheel. We should not do what happened to automatic control in the 80s, where the academics went left and the practitioners went straight ahead. Right? And they stopped building their transactions in automatic control because they thought that the Banach spaces are nice, but I live in an Euclidean world. So we have to be careful not to go left. And I think that a good way to avoid that is to keep in mind new applications that need a new wheel, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, well, what we have does not work in this one, that's not good. I think that's good.
Okay, I've got a couple slides that I want to try and present, so let me go through and present them. I try and come up with catchy titles, that way I can distinguish my talks on the CD. I want to actually start in reverse direction in a couple of the protocol, a couple of questions that were mentioned earlier. Rubashi, you mentioned this first one, how do higher layer protocols adapt to changes in the PHY and MAC? And I think that there's a set of researchers who exist on one side of this threshold and researchers who exist on the other side. And that's really what I mean by this blood-brain barrier. I'll show you some slides of why that analogy works. But that really, to me, is the big question.
In my defense, I can say I think it needs to go the other way as well, which is part of what I was trying to end with, is that PHY also needs to figure out how to better support higher
layers. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The barrier goes both ways. And then we had this discussion earlier about this idea of integrated MAC and routing protocols. And the question I started to think about was, is it really integrated, or is it just that they're separate but have a pretty significant impact on each other? All right, so I'm doing this talk in reverse. I'm doing the questions first. And then let me start to talk about my conclusions in reverse order. The reason why I want to do this is I think a lot of us have hit on the fact that there are very interesting network architecture possibilities. One of the reasons why they're interesting is because it greatly expands the ranges that we're used to dealing with in delay, loss, and jitter. And then this other aspect that I've been focusing on a little bit is the difference between connectivity and disconnectivity. And whether you have applications and transport protocols and routing protocols that all presume that there's a connection, but then it might break, or whether it's disconnected and then you might periodically have connectivity. A quick slide here talking about round-trip times to Mars. They can be on the order of hours. Clearly, that extends the range of delay from microseconds and milliseconds up into hours. And that's the part that makes things at the MAC and PHY layer interesting because of the expanded ranges that we have to deal with. Spectrum of connectivity. You've got continuous connectivity and autonomous operation as the two ends of the spectrum. And I think what starts to be interesting is when you navigate that spectrum and you introduce these concepts of intermittent disconnectivity, intermittent connectivity, and then infrequent connectivity. And then just watch the ripples have an effect as you move across the network of transport and then the application spaces. And this works for both topology variations, and then you can also look at this from an end-to-end perspective as well, just to sort of give you a sense then. I'm going to skip this next slide if you're interested about this big government program called TSAT and how it does all sorts of really funky things. Ask me during lunch. Second conclusion I wanted to make, and this goes back to this idea of the blood-brain barrier, and that there's
in my mind, there's a. I did this slide earlier. I thought there was a clear delineation between what happens at the Phi and Mach layers and then everything else. Now, it's not the case that those things don't have an impact, but really, is this a place where we want to do cross-layer design? I'm trying to be controversial here and to say we need to be very careful as we try and navigate across this line. The next three or four slides talk about this blood-brain barrier, but essentially what happens is you've got blood flowing past the brain, and everything that's in the blood gets translated into the brain and then has all these weird kinds of implications. And there's a tremendous amount of research that looks at how do you get drugs across that brain-blood barrier, what kind of impact it has, and then the reverse as well, how the brain and its various interactions affect the flow of blood. And it's really that kind of barrier that I think exists in networking, that there's an impact and it flows in both directions, and almost the way that this group seems to divide up is whether you're interested in one side of that barrier or whether you're interested in the other side. And in the interest of time, if you really want to see the rest of these slides and how I go through and define these things and pictures and all sorts of cool things outside of computer science, it's online or you can ask me about it at lunch. The last thing I want to talk about, and this is this warning that we might be creating a networking winter. And this is what Manny just talked about with OS. Same thing with HCI. For a long time, they were asking the question of, okay, we invented the mouse, now what? And there was a pretty significant gap to, you know, the trackball and the touchpad, and now we're starting to see more innovation in that space. Same thing with operating systems. It's a case that there's pretty much two or a handful of dominant operating systems, so what are the OS researchers really off trying to do? And what we have to be careful about in computer science is, if a lot of the networking problems boil down to delay, loss, and jitter, or connectivity or disconnectivity, and we're just re-spinning those same things, layering it with new kinds of application problems, and then churning the old results, and then changing them a little bit and sending them back down, we are pretty much creating an insular academic community that's independent of industry. This point came up in the last discussion about the distinction between theoreticians and practitioners, and I would say that gap is fairly small, but the gap between theoreticians and practitioners as a group and what happens in industry is fairly significant. At the same time, there are some good examples of organizations that have tried really hard to bridge that barrier. The two that come to mind initially are some of the work that was done at Sprint Labs and some of the network measurement stuff. I also think a lot of the Intel lablets are doing a fairly good job in that sense. I've had particular interactions where we look at problems with 802.11 and then we try and get that translated into the NIC code that Intel's trying to deploy. And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to maintain the connectivity. It's not that we have to be involved in the standards process. They're going to do what they're going to do, but it's more an impact of whether or not our research ends up in products or ends up generating research or industrial research or new products or new revenue in the future. Now, the last caveat that I'll add to that is one of our jobs as academics is to train people who go off in industry and then have the ability to build those tools. I tell my students that your job is not to come up with the next super innovative, super creative solution, that you're largely in training, and that what you're trying to do is add tools to your toolbox about how to creatively think, how to assess systems, how to do evaluation. Now, we really try and focus on creativity and give them creative solutions, but it's training as grad students that they can then go off and do innovative things, which means, and this is setting the level of expectations for myself fairly low. I don't necessarily expect to come up with super innovative solutions all the time, but to train students who go off and then become successful, and I can live vicariously through their success. That's a nice little bar to meet, so I do that every day. Okay, so back to the questions, and then just to finish up this panel with the additional questions and discussion that anybody's got.
So I'm going to go back to what Pascal started and your last point about the distance between academics and corporations and standards. I don't think we should be getting into standards. I agree with Manny, but there are a lot of examples. I mean, I'm coming from the Bay Area, and there are a lot of examples there where algorithms, ideas from the universities, they're directly integrated into the industry, to startups, through bigger companies that they buy out startups. So there is a way, and it's a relatively simple, I would say, way, easy way, relatively, to actually happening on the industry, not through standards.
But is it the case that we're seeing a lot of that kind of activity in the wireless networking space? And somehow I get the feeling, I mean, sensor nets, yes. I mean, I see a lot of startups in that space. But in general, a lot of these, you know, ad hoc networking ideas, you know.
Well, then maybe we should reconsider, I don't know, how they are. Maybe we should,
right, exactly. So the point is there ever a point at which it provides a feedback and a reality check on?
But I think we just have to be comfortable with different timescales on impact.
It seems like there's a shorter time to market because it's a very concrete thing, right? Here's the link that you're. But somehow, when you get into sort of higher layer protocols, it seems the transition either is very slow or almost never happens. I don't know what it is. If I'm being too business.
So I don't know. I mean, I attended a panel actually which Ratul was on in Infocom. I don't know how many of you went there, but people were wondering whether many of us are actually working on niche areas, like underwater networks, UWB. Where are these devices, right? And there are so many of us who are basically excited by these possibilities. We spend hours writing papers, and therefore the industry is not really going to kind of embrace these things. I mean, scalability in ad hoc networks is great, but where are the ad hoc networks today, right? So I think, to me, I think basically 802.11, even though we trash it so much, I think if, like what Kevin was saying, I mean, if we actually have an idea that can do 802.11, that could possibly be more influential in the community as opposed to kind of doing something which is very, very focused on the chain.
I think we may be too anxious about when we're going to see our babies being used by
industry.
I mean, Tobagi's and Kangar's papers on CSMA were in the 70s, and able to eliminate this happening, 30 years after that. So it's one thing to try to do some tweaking of technology, but some of the basic results we are doing, won't see true application maybe 10, 20, 20 years from now. That's basically.
One quick thing. I think that disconnect actually is the reason why I personally think, at least in the systems context, reinventing the wheel is not such a bad thing. Often when practitioners go looking for a solution, they usually look in recent literature. So if you're like solving the same problems but within a new current context, at least in a concrete context, that's not necessarily bad from a bad perspective.
Yeah, one I was earlier comment where about 802.11 research. Right, maybe short term or maybe not particularly exciting because they're not going to change the standard dramatically. One thing I do want to point out is that it is possible to do research and MAC protocols looking at concepts that you try out at 802.11 but are in fact more general, right? So you can look at things like power control. I mean, it's not like 802.11 protocol is the only one where you have to worry about potential power control. And so I think it's important that you don't just say anything that you try out in 802.11 is a tweak to 802.11. You can't set right.
I think we have to be careful about this short-term versus long-term returns, right? Because it depends very much on the industry sector and how much it's open to innovation and new ideas, how much people can quickly make money by, for instance, we had great success with satellite internet because at that point nobody else was doing it. But I don't think I could do the same with the classical internet because everybody's buried behind their own markets and threat protected. Just remember, as JJ said, okay, it took 50 years for sound results to even find an application, 30 years for any level. One suggestion is that, when you talk about home networks, you try to ask, do we really have mobile home networks anywhere? I can give you two examples where you have something close to it. One is military networks and the other is vehicular networks. You can argue how practical each case is. But if you want to have an impact, in the defense you will, because the defense will do whatever they need to do. And currently they are in an abysmal state as far as getting whatever you call them, mobile or networks with some hierarchies to actually give any useful bandwidth. So So there you're going to have impact. If you do something interesting, you will have impact. What do I mean by that? Some research labs and some experiments, they may use your results. If you expect to see this in the army radios, wait until about 5 or 10 years. So we've got to understand the scale. So try to get very agitated about things that are going to happen tomorrow. I don't think it's going to happen. Vehicular ad hoc networks is another iffy story, right? You talk to Honda and they tell you every time I try to translate the communication network protocols and information to something that's going to control a mechanical system like a car, which can kill people, I have to be extremely careful, right? So they can, you can see very nice demos in Japan of cars cooperating and motorbikes exchanging information, but I don't think you're going to see, you know, particular networks, okay, being controlling cars in a hot fashion real soon. So we have to be careful. But this doesn't mean that they are not very interesting problems and that we have to necessarily think along the lines of traditional math. On the contrary, I actually even have objections to what math means in the way people think about it. If you, because if you go against the layers, that changes completely.
I guess because John yesterday said I make recommendations to young people and then make recommendations to maybe more senior members. I'm going to have to go. But one of the issues I see is the very challenging issue is the sort of distinction between, or maybe the boundary between being a scholar and being an engineer. And I find myself as a junior person constantly in this position of sort of doing your own new thing and sort of producing something interesting and innovative in, you know, with some norm, I don't, you know, not very much, but, and also on the other hand, doing scholarship in terms of organizing what has been done and sort of understanding the history so that you don't repeat it, right? And there's always a tension in between, and I think as I look up to the senior members of the community, what I would like to see is sort of a more towards the scholarship with less pressure now that we, you know, someone has established themselves as extremely creative and innovative and won all these awards. So maybe it's a time to actually sort of get a perspective of sort of large area of work that isn't math and sort of put it in some perspective that you know, helps us not repeat the history because it will help us understand that the scholarship and the field.
It's one important friendly amendment, okay, that some of us that are old enough, we still go to the basement of libraries to find the real have copy classical references and read them. You don't just go to Google and find the references that exist and we call this and you know what it's valid. Okay. So with that amendment, yes, we should do that.
2 minutes, John.
So I wanted to push a very different question for a different kind of impact. So one way to have impact is to get things out there, and the key thing to get things out there is it's got to be cheap. And so actually, there's a comment, maybe we'll remove carriage sense to get cheap. It's actually, that's absolutely the worst thing possible to do. The way to get cheap is be commodity, right? And I think JJ mentioned it yesterday. What happens, you know, these 8-11 chips are so cheap, you know, have 5, have 10. See what you can do with that, right? So the question I have is, lots of people were interested in sub-5 radios. Are they ever, is the business case for them ever going to be strong enough that they will, that user reprogrammable software radios will be cheap and deployable?
And let's take that question to lunch. Software